And I'll just hand over to Vincennes, 2D Crystals this morning.
Thanks, Ron. So now that we passed all the introductory lectures, it's time to dive into the different subspecialties a little bit and get you up to speed on how you actually analyze images and what the principles are. And what I will try to do over the next 60 minutes or so is to give you an intuitive understanding on what electron crystallographic processing of two-dimensional crystals involves. So I apologize to all of those of you that have a firm background in physics and math. So there will be some, but not very much, right? It will be really try to drive home the principles, especially for those of you who are more firmly grounded in the biological sciences and have to go home and sit there and say, oh my God. So that is basically it. And to start this all off, so what we basically want to attempt to do is the same as trying to have you solve the task of looking at yourself from about 20 feet up, down, and then say, what do I want to do with this? Right? Because if you think of yourself as you sit here, the seating arrangement basically shapes you into being some sort of a two-dimensional array. Right. So what we will be talking about, the concept that we want to explore, is basically just to turn you from an utterly disordered array that will diffract to no amount of resolution into something that pays attention and is nicely ordered so that we can actually get some information out of it. Right? But before we start that, actually, I wanted to remind you that, you know, microscopy has been actually an extremely useful tool for mankind for a long time from the very beginning. So this is at Larsen's source, that the early microscopes were used to look at rather coarse detail. Right? And with the introduction of Philips microscopes and Georg microscopes and the likes, we actually have made progress to look at slightly more sophisticated objects. Right? And what we want to do now is we actually want to focus our attention and start looking at two-dimensional arrays. Now, what are two-dimensional crystals? As had been mentioned before, this is what they look like as a schematic on the left side. And here's an actual example. And the reason why I put that in here is that we want to do just, you know, in the sense of the quote that has been given earlier by Feynman, you just look at it. And by just looking at it, we will already be able to grasp a lot of the concepts that are required to deal with this type of specimen if we want to do digital image processing. So here it goes. By definition, a two-dimensional crystal is just an ordered array of molecules that are in an XY plane. And as it's drawn out here, it would be just a single layer of, let's say, a membrane protein embedded in a lipid bilayer. But as you have seen yesterday, it could also be some sort of a soluble protein that is assembled on a lipid-water interface where you have some lipids that have affinity groups being able to catch a protein. Right. Now, if you are lucky enough to get something like this and you do a negatively stained image, and you put get a negatively stained sample, put it in a microscope and take a picture, this is how it looks like. So now what 2D crystallography is all about is just to figure out how can I describe this beast here without using the picture itself. So that is basically the task that you have to perform. You have to come up with some sort of a formalism or mass formalism that will allow you to describe objects like this without using the picture. Well, you use the picture to some extent, but you know you don't want to really look at the picture while you're doing it. So what does that formalism has to accomplish? Well, you know, humans are amazing beings. If you look at it, the one thing you notice, there is something here. Right, and you would describe this as, well, it's sort of patterned. It's not random. It's regular. Which already tells us that somehow we will have to deal with periodic functions in the description of it, because if we want to describe this whole thing, we just have to describe it in some way that will be able to create something periodic. What else does that formalism have to accomplish? Well, what it also has to accomplish is that you can very easily spot there's a boundary here. Past that, there is no crystal anymore. You can also very easily see that down here in this right corner, there is some sort of a tear or disturbance in the crystal where it's not well formed. Same as here, over here. So something is going wrong there with the crystal packing, and whatever the formalism is that we're going to invent should be able to pick that up. All right? Now, there's one thing I just said, is as I look at this tear here in the right corner or, you know, over here to the left, That actually, as simple as that description, it drives home another important concept for the 2D crystallography, and that is I've picked a point of reference. If I say this is in the right, then obviously I was thinking as of this corner here as my mental point of reference that I would be using to describe locations of whatever feature I can see in my image. Right. Now, that picking of an origin in real space, or picking a point of reference, is what eventually will allow us to calculate these phase contributions that are so important in coming up with a description of what the actual object is. So what you can very easily do by eye, now we have learned, will involve somehow periodic functions, and as all of you know, periodic functions have something to do with amplitudes, how much of that function is there, and how is it shifted through its periodic cycle, which is a phase contribution. And somehow this is able to describe this. And that is what we want to discover together. And to start this, we basically just say, well, what do you do? So you take a crystal, you take a picture, you put it into a densitometer, and you digitize it. Right? That is the very first step learning on how we start dealing with this, because now we see in the digitized trace exactly what our eye has been picking up on immediately. And that is that the array of optical densities that you scan along each of the lines is some sort of a periodically repeating pattern. Right? So our first port of call, will be to find out how can we describe something like that mathematically. And more specifically, we were also aware of the fact that somewhere the crystal stops and somewhere there is faults. And by the way, not all of the unit cells actually looked alike on the repeat. That is, we have to somehow deal with the fact or exploit the fact that, yes, in principle, this optical density trace will be periodic, but it will also have some sort of irregularities, that some features are not there in every single one of the unit cells, that it's squished, that it's not exactly in the right position along the x-axis, and these sort of things we have to sort of tease out. Right? Now you say, where is all this going? Well, where this all is going is that we are lucky in the 2D crystallography of 2D crystals that we have the simplest of all possible cases to deal with image processing. Right? And it's not just the simplest, it's also the most powerful, really. Right? I mean, don't let these single particle guys scare you, right? Or fool you. I mean, if you have a crystal, there's nothing that will be better. And that is why we will be all doing crystallography 10 years from now again. But that's, you know, that's putting time pressure on me, Bob. So here's basically what we want to discover is that we say, let's just say you have a periodic function like the one I've sort of been showing you. And then what David has been talking about yesterday is that in Fourier theory, if you think about this, any type of periodic function, as a matter of every type of object, can be represented by a simple sum. If you have something that is not periodic, you would have to replace a sum by an integral, but the principle is the same, is of simple periodic functions, basically, that have a certain, that are all multiple integrals of a basic repeat function, right? So that basically means that you will define a wave that repeats once over that distance of the repeat, and then every single component that you later will be adding or that you have to determine will have to be an integral multiple of that basic repeat. And the reason why it has to be a multiple integral of this is that if you were to take a wave throw it into the equation that is repeating somewhere and spilling over into the next unit cell as you go over your long crystal, it will increasingly just get out of register and it will just add to every single unit cell in a different way. Right? And that's exactly the type of terrorism we can't accept in our 2D crystals, right? Because it's just annihilating things, bits and pieces, in spaces where we just don't want it to happen. So for some of you, this will tell everything, right? And you don't need to see anymore. You know, however, when I started this, I came from a biochemistry background. I was looking at this and say, yeah, I know this is Greek. Right? This is how far my understanding went in the early days. That are not that long ago. But to just show you what that actually means is what I've done. I've given you an explicit sample. So what we want to do is we want to look at this target function here and see how can we build this target function in a manner like this. So it says take a constant. So here we go. We just take a constant, and since it's a constant, it's just a line. It doesn't really make what phase shift. You know, if I shift this over, it's not really going to change anything much, right? So I just draw a constant, and I arbitrarily choose an amplitude of 2. So there it is, right? Then I go and say, now the summation says put a component in there that is one basic repeat, right? So So I've given this amplitude, a phase of 0. It starts here, so it's cosine of x. And what the sum of the two is, as prescribed, is now you see a cosine, but it's not oscillating about 0 as it would. It's oscillating about 2, right, with an amplitude of plus minus 1. That's basically what the first summation step does. So now you go just on and you put it, put the second thing in. So I put an arbitrary amplitude of 0.7, and again a phase of 0, right? So if I sum these two, what is happening is that you see now we go from an amplitude of 3 to slightly higher, because there is some places where there's a positive contribution from here, and you start making little ditches halfway through, right? So there is nothing magic. You know, if you wanted, the crystallographers are the dumbest of all people. All they do is summing sort of sines and cosines together, maybe. Now, if we go in here, is we have the third component, and that doesn't really match. It just, you know, it says I have to go. Okay, so it just lifts this little leg up. The fourth component, as it turned out, has an amplitude of 0. That can happen. Not every of the components has to have a contribution. And the last time, by the time we have a fifth component in there that is now oscillating very frequently over the basic units I repeat, we sum that back in, and voila, we've sort of generated our target function. Right. And what you can do here is you can make this incredibly complicated and add many more functions, and you can extend it into two dimensions. This is all just, you know, going from chocolate flavor to vanilla flavor, but it's all the same thing, really. It's just adding these functions together to describe this. So in other words, our task in the microscope and in the image processing is to take our image and decompose it into these different components, right? And to give you just a real-life example, if you think of it, what we do here is really nothing different from what you do in your kitchen when you cook a lasagna. Okay? So what we do need to make a lasagna is we need to know, A, what the components are. Right? Those would be the constituent wave components that go into the whole thing. You need to know roughly how much you need. Right? Otherwise, you head it for disaster. The how much is the amplitude information, right? And if you want to be a real chef, you better know what the order of the ingredients is, right? Because you don't want to put tomatoes in before the pasta. That's not doing you any good, right? And that is the phase information, right? Where and when, sort of, right? Things have to be added to come up with a coherent picture. Now, to put this to a proof or to a test, what I'm going to show you here is one of these low-dose images now of a two-dimensional crystal, and that is a rather contrasty one, so that you actually by eye can already see that there's a repetitive thing in here. And the periodic repeat has been placed on a continuous carbon support film, which is just amorphous, right? Now, what we luckily can do is we can computationally come up with a Fourier transform, like David was explaining yesterday, so we discretely just find out what are the frequencies and how do they all add up together to come up with the image. And that is how the computed Fourier transform looks like. And I inverted it, right, so that you know, you see black dots on white. It's easier to display, actually, and see. So what do you see? Right? Well, you see a lot of things. Right? You see dotty things. You see these strange changes in bright and dark and bright and dark. And if you paid attention over the past 2 days, you would know, okay, those have to be the tone rings, right? And then you see a lot of black things in there. But the thing that we are after, really, has all to do with that being the beam stops, the undiffracted beam. And as you can tell, that is a periodic contribution, because what you do is you just pick two unit cell length vectors in that calculated transform, and at any integral multiples of these basic repeats in any directions where they intersect, you will have one of these strong diffraction maxima. And that is exactly that you say each of these strong maxima is one of these wave components that we will be taking and adding into the whole to just sum up and create an image of the structure that we're interested in. So then the question comes, and each of them has a name. You know, this one, for example, is a curve that would be the curve that has repeated 5 times over the unit cell. So it's going 5 times over the basic repeat in this particular case. Right? And now the thing about it is that you say you have an awful lot of stuff in between. Where's all the stuff in between coming from? That shouldn't be there if it was all crystal, but mind you, we have a continuous carbon support film there. right? And that would basically go in from a crystalline ordered object to a single object where we have to replace the sum with an integral. And replacing the sum with an integral is what making all the mess in between. And now we can already see why 2D crystallography is so powerful, especially if you compare it to single particle, because we only care for the information that is in the strong maxima, because we know that is what describes our object, and everything else is rubbish. Right? Now, the single particle people, unfortunately, have no discrete diffraction. They just have the rubbish. Right? And you will see over the coming days that they really have a hard time dealing with this, because having that is really daunting. You have to deal with deconvoluting the signal, the weak signal, wimpy signal that comes from your individual molecules, and somehow make sense out of it. And they're scratching their heads, and you know, every now and then they get it completely wrong. Right? If you look into the literature, and I hope that Nico will, you know, follow up on this tomorrow. Anyway, so this is basically what you see. So you have spots at regular spacings that come from the crystal, and you have the aperiodic carbon giving you some transform value everywhere else, including the positions where your peaks are. Right? So there is some signal there too that comes from the carbon, but it's sort of negligible. Right? And it's negligible because on the crystal you take thousands of molecules. They're all perfectly aligned, so we hope. And that all adds up to give you an average signal from all these thousand molecules, which is way above the background, right? So we have no problem seeing where our signal is and what it means. Now, the first question then concerning the processing is, what can you do with a diffraction pattern like this? All right? Well, the first thing you can exploit in the processing here is that you say, well, this is great. If we know that all our signal is right there, then we can do in the first step what we call digital filtering. So this is just an enlargement of part of the transform, and here you can see, so there's all background, and there you have the little diffraction maxima here. So what you can do computationally, of course, you can generate a second Fourier transform in which you just cut out only the parts that you're interested in and set everything to zero. Right? That's like in the example I gave you, one of the amplitudes was not there, it's adding zero everywhere, so it doesn't exist. So in other words, what we can do is we can digitally filter our transform to enhance the periodic information. Right? And if we were to do it in a way like this, that we cut out the maximum and some of the stuff that is around the maximum, then we come up with a transform like this. And now, in contrast to the X-ray crystallography case, we're not lost because our calculated transforms have phase information. And the reason why we have the phase information is that the image that we use to calculate the transform is basically like an inline hologram. You have an interference pattern recorded that is between the undiffracted beam and the diffracted components. And if you digitize that, then that interference pattern contains phase information, information about how much these different curves, components have all been out of register, right, at the time when they arrived at your photographic detector, really. So we have phase information, so that basically means we can do just that Fourier summation inverted by adding all these components up and generate an image again. That's the beauty of it all. If we do that, we go from this. Yes? Where is the phase information? Well, it's in the number that is in the computer, but that is not the answer you want to hear. So where is the phase information? So the whole thing is, if I ask you, just try to describe to the rest of the people, okay, where I am in this room. Not who I am, just where.
You want me to do it?
Yeah, just yeah, so this is basically what you do, is you pick a point of reference and say, well, from that corner, I'm about 2.5 feet away. Well, you know, if I go here, I use the same point of reference, I'm no longer 2.5 feet, I'm 3 feet away or 4 feet away, right? So I've moved in space. So how would you describe this in terms of periodic functions? If you take just a whole glob of periodic functions that have all been aligned to describe an object and you want to move them, you have to apply phase shift to all of them. Right? This is what David said in his lecture yesterday, is that if you take a crystal and you translate it, you're not changing the intensities, but you do change the phases in all of the reflection, because the phase contains information about location inside the image with regard to a given image origin. Right? So this is basically where the phase information comes. You arbitrarily pick an origin, and then you can calculate how the curves have to be shifted with respect to each other to regenerate the periodic object that you see with reference to that point. But if you know that, how you have to shift the curve, you do know what the phase is, and that is basically what shows up in your calculated diffraction pattern. Right? That you know how much there is, but the calculated diffraction pattern will also contain information of how much do the curves have to be shifted with respect to each other. Right? And that is what, yeah?
So looking at the diffraction pattern, it's not obvious why you have phases in X-ray crystallographers.
Okay. That's a good question, and so sort of there was a touch on yesterday, is that when you calculate a diffraction pattern, right, then what you do is you have some sort of square detector, so you put this there and you just record the intensities of the waves as they arrive there. Mine is a calculated diffraction pattern that basically takes, I take an image, I have to tell the program where in the image do you want your origin to be, and that is basically creating a point of reference for describing the periodicities of all the components. That is a big, big difference there, right? So don't be fooled. If you were to calculate, or if you were to record a true electron diffraction pattern, the phase information is gone, okay? So you cannot just invert that, and Bob had been telling that, is that you say, so in electron microscopy, you're very lucky that you can switch between the two worlds, actually. You can record true diffraction information that has no phase information attached. But you also can record the holograms, that is, the images, and because there are true interference patterns, you can actually recreate the phase information from that or calculate it. Okay, so in this case, what we have done, we basically have calculated this by just taking a relatively large chunk out of the transform, and that's what we get. Well, if you're polling the audience, right, this definitely looks better like this. For one, you can certainly see what the periodicity is, right? But overall, it looks still pretty ugly, right? So if you have a collaborator, it's not exactly what you want to show them, because they would think that you don't know what you're doing. But actually that it looks that way is a huge, huge advantage, right? So looks can be very deceiving. And that brings us to the point where, you know, I have to entertain David because he requested it yesterday. What we can just briefly think of this is, what is that actually showing us, right? Other than just a projection of back calculated, you know, inverse transform of the of a projected image of the crystal. Well, you know, you see squishing, and if you were at this higher scale, you would also see that these things don't really sit all on the same positions as they should be and whatnot, right? So that brings us to the very fact is that you say, when you process a two-dimensional crystal, what sort of crystal defects are you expecting, right? Well, there are a couple of defects. So the first defect you have, and that's by far the easiest one, is just translational disorder. All right, and that basically means that instead of being here, I'm here. That should be no brainer. And in fact, that is the only thing that we're correcting, but it does wonders for us. There are other forms of disorder in a crystal. Right? For that, I need the chair, otherwise I can't sort of demonstrate this. So looking very funny. Okay? So there's one type of disorder that you could say, well, you know, if instead of looking at me, you are fatally attracted to the person next to you, you, for all purposes, rotationally disordered. Right? Now, rotational disorder is violating crystal laws because crystals are defined by defined contacts between molecules, or as you will see in type of aquaporin, lipids sticking in between. So if you have these practical jokers that just rotate, right, they're breaking these contacts, and we don't bother recording that or correcting for that, even though it could be done in principle, because you can always make better crystals, hopefully. Right? And then, but that is still something we could treat if we wanted it. And then we have the third thing that comes in, and that is exactly representing how you will be looking in the evening talk, you know, not upright anymore, but you turn into couch potatoes. Right? So that is out of plane tilt, which can happen either by the molecule being slanted or by the carbon film just going up, tilting the entire crystal locally by a certain amount up. Now that is a nasty one, because that means that the molecular transform and the projection of the object is bound to change, and that is very difficult to correct if I don't know what the structure is. If I had the structure solved, then I could in principle go back and correct for this as well. But what's the point? At that point I have the structure, right? So I first have to come up with a crystal where I ignore all but translational disorder, solve the structure, then I publish, and then I don't care anymore anyway. You know, because what David didn't tell you is that you see spots, you're excited, and that is really true, but you're all excited for different reasons. If you're a student, you're excited because you know you will graduate. If you're a postdoc, you're excited because you know there will be a job for you. right? And if you're a faculty member, you get excited because you think, or you trick yourself into thinking that NIH may fund you after all. So that is basically where we are here. So we see that, and that you say it looks ugly, but part of this ugliness is containing information that is critical for us to make any movement. And that is containing information about translational disorder, and although we don't like it, rotational disorder and out-of-plane tilt. And of course that contains noise. But that we can deal with through averaging later on. Now, how would you then go about dealing with this? Well, one way of dealing with this is doing exactly the same thing that the human resource people do when they hire new people for Baywatch and say, we don't need ugly, we need pretty. So let's make pretty. Right? Same image, same transform, that's filtered image. So what's the difference between this and the other one? Well, the difference between those two is that we have used a very small mass gradient and really just picked out the information that is on the true diffraction peak where we expect it. Everything else we just said doesn't exist. Now, of course, if you do this, what you do create is an idealized copy of your object, and it is perfectly periodic and beautiful. Right? In other words, if you have a collaborator that waits for feedback, that is what you show them, because it takes you a minute to do, looks very pretty, right? Do you know they will frame it and put it on their desk next to their wives and kids and dream about big papers and contributions to science? And then you go back and you deal with ugly things and make it really beautiful in the long run. So how would that work? How can you play the big and ugly out against the small and beautiful, right? To come up with something useful? Well, the way you can do is that you say, well, even though this is beautiful, it has lost all the information about translational disorder, most of it, rotational disorder, a lot of the noise is all gone, right? And now you ask yourself, why is it all gone? Well, because I pretend it's a perfect crystal that has no disorder. So if you have translational disorder, then what we said is basically we expect our diffraction maxima to be in certain positions that are exactly predictable by the dimension of our two unit cell repeats. You know, so the emergency exits are to the left and to the right, so that would make a very bad unit cell, but you know. Anyway, so let's make some sort of an angle. So I know exactly if that's the length, that direction, the next diffraction maximum would be exactly two arm lengths in that direction. Now, if you have translational disorder on a large scale, what you basically have is no longer a single crystal. You just have a collective of crystals that have all very similar unit cell dimensions. But that basically means this is like me after three coffees. You know, I can't point steady anymore. So you have a little jitter in the unit cell vectors. And that means that all the diffraction information starts blurring out as you go farther and farther and farther out in reciprocal space. Right? Because what is a tiny little jitter, if I had an arm that were five times as long, would be a whacking sort of movement by the time I go to the really far end of it, right? And that basically means, okay, so here is our opportunity, how we can deal with it. We can actually pick this image, which pretends there is no disorder, to generate a reference telling us what it is we're actually looking for in our images. Make sense? And then what we're going to do is we take that reference and compare to all the possible unit cell locations in our image, and determine how well it fits with our reference and whether it actually is sitting on the right position. Right? So to understand what I just said, we have to think about two procedures, autocorrelation and cross-correlation, because those are the principal tools that are helping us to accomplish what I just said. Autocorrelation means take two copies of an identical function, and then what you do is you basically say, well, you just sum them up, and you say, this is one. And now you just start shifting the function systematically, one direction and the other direction. You sum them all up and see what is the total sum. Right? And what you will find is that the total agreement between these two curves comes from a maximum where all points add up coherently. It slowly starts off falling off to zero when you have taken that function and basically displaced it one repeat over. Because then there is no overlap anymore, so there's nothing, the sum will return to you. That's an autocorrelation function. And the beautiful thing about autocorrelation function is you can do this with any object yourself, you know, the juice bottle, crystals, your ribosomes, you know, you pick whatever you want, right? And you will always get the same answer, sort of a blob. That is maximum when the two objects are perfectly in register and monotonously falls to zero if you just shift them away one size of the object from each other. Okay, so we can of course do the same thing, but instead of considering two identical copies, we consider two copies that are similar but not identical. And that is exactly what our crystal would be. Remember, we digitize that, but not every repeat is exactly the same. You know, you have changes in the noise and the optical density in the image and whatnot. So this would be the repeat we're interested in, and this would be the function that is sort of the perfect, idealized, pretty picture of the object that we're looking for. Now what you can see is that you say there's still a bump here, there's still sort of a bump over here, so you do will have some sort of a maximum in the cross-correlation function, but it will be far from perfect. So it will be a lower cross-correlation value to start with, and again, as you start shifting these two against each other, it will fall off to zero. That's great, because what we've just covered is that we say we can take the pretty function, calculate, well, we can take the pretty function as a reference, compare to all the unit cells on the lattice, and that will tell us it's either a perfect match, or remember the area in the image I showed you where there was no crystal at all, it would tell, well, who are you kidding? Okay, there's nothing here. Right? So that will basically be a way for us to distinguish between crystalline areas and non-crystalline areas, and crystalline areas that for some reason have been damaged or badly tilted out of plane so that the projection looks completely different, we will get cross-correlation values that are low or lower. Now, how do we deal with the distortion? Well, with the distortion, we deal this way, that if you now go back to the ideal case for simplicity and you say you have two ideal copies that are shifted against by a certain amount x, then what you will generate as a cross-correlation peak is a peak that looks exactly like the autocorrelation peak because the functions are, after all, exactly the same. But the peak will be just displaced by the same distance as the two functions are in the real world. Right? So in other words, if I take this function, shift it over by delta x, I generate this, so that means my correlation value will be 1. And by the time I have them aligned like this, out of register, I'm starting here with a lower value just. So everything is like an autocorrelation, but it's just shifted over by a certain amount. Does that make sense? Now, but that is exactly the magic number I need. I need to know if there's translational disorder. I need to know, am I at 3 foot or 3.5? Right? And if you had something that looks like a human, you can use this as a search model to determine that. In other words, what we do is we calculate an autocorrelation profile from our reference area, which is perfect, in quotation marks, right? Which generates a bump. And we can use that bump to actually search the room or the crystal for the other cross-correlation peaks and print down what the XY coordinates are. And then it really comes down to comparing. Where should it be based on the lattice, and where is it in reality? Does that still make sense? So what we do in other cases, in other words, is we calculate a two-dimensional, in this case, autocorrelation peak, which is, as I promised, a little bump. And we calculate a cross-correlation map, which is a series of bumps. And now all I do is I take this as a search model, being generated from the pretty tightly filtered image, and let it loose on the cross-correlation map that has been generated from a loosely filtered image that contains information about the distortion. Because if I still have that information, what I will find is that some of these cross-correlation peaks are not on the exact peak position. Right? So just to make it sure, so if if this is two unit cells here, okay, and I'm in line third, and this is where I start my search. Now, if I have a perfect lattice, what I will find is that I step one unit cell, I'm right on top of that chair. Well, you know, if that unit cell is not here, the search algorithm still will make the step. And then it says, it's lost, okay? There's nothing. So it's like, you know, in New England or Maryland in the winter, all the pools are empty, and if you jump in, hard landing, All right, so what it does, it gets panicky. It says, where's the peak? So it starts looking for the peak in the house. There it is. So you put that position down, and then you go on, and you say, you jump, and it says, oh, well done. You know, this one is just right, okay? And so you keep going. For each unit cell on the ladders, you just repeat that game where you just jump and say, is it here? If it's not here, where is it? I search for it. And then you write a very long list with the positions of the correlation peaks. And once you've done that, actually correcting for the translational disorder becomes an absolute no-brainer. Yeah?
Is this something that's unique to 2D crystals being
healed? X-ray people have the same problem, but there is very little they can do about it because they don't have face information. See, the only reason we can do this is because we have the face information. And the face information in the calculated transform is what contains information where things are. Right? In the 3D case, you see that your spots all of a sudden turn into bananas and blur out. So you know there is long-range disorder, but you have not a chance on the planet, right, to do anything about it other than going back to the courtroom or, you know, switch your robot on and make another 1,500 conditions and try, you know, sort of these. But, you know, in the 2D case, so we're sort of not desperate, but we're fortunate that we can take even bad crystals and just make them into nice crystals. And so that is, of course, what we all want. All right, so that is basically the way how we deal with this. So the way how you then collect or correct for the translational disorder is simply that you say, now you turn into caring parent, right, and you collect your kids and toys in the living room so that the guests can come in for the dinner party and it looks respectable. You just say, you're naughty, I know where you are, but I put you back into your place. All right, here we go. Now what I've just done is I basically took part of a lattice vector that was out here and made it point back into the right direction. So in other words, what I'm doing is I'm collecting all the blurred diffraction information in my Fourier transform and put it back on the predicted peak position. And by doing that, I basically ramp up the signal enormously. So in other words, after I'm done with what we call unbending or lattice straightening, I should be able to see diffraction maxima that were completely obscured by disorder and other noisy things before. And that is actually indeed the case. Oh, this is just to show you cross-correlation maps. So they have two components, peak high, peak distortion, right? So it tells you how much it is distorted, but this is just all graphics, right? And it tells you how good the correlation was. So you can, for example, tell the crystal is here, and then there's just carbon film. There's nothing over here. So you can then go in and box this out and, you know, do several tricks to make this all nicer. But the whole purpose of doing this is that you actually go from some crystal that diffracts to, let's say, 12 angstrom or so-ish. And after you've done the unbending, you basically double the resolution. Right? Yeah.
How big typically is the shift that you apply to individual units?
Small. Small. Well, see, the bumping thing is, you know, in your image, a unit cell is basically just a bunch of pixel, you know, let's say 100 by 100 pixel, and you just take that whole bunch and you just shift it over, and you leave a little wiggle room so that you can sort of taper it in with the other one. So you do a little least square thing that is a tiny little local jitter to make sure that there will be no vacuum areas in between the corrected peaks, right? And the algorithms are in some way also smart that if you have, for example, a curvature in your crystal, it learns that, actually. So it learns that the thing is curving so that if it keeps going, searching for it, it will not be hopping this way and associated, but it will go along the crystal so it knows where the real peak is and how it should be dealing with that later in the...
Yeah, so it can actually keep... So it doesn't go completely out of register.
Correct. Correct, right. That is, and you know, usually the distortions, they are a couple of angstrom, all right, on 100 units. So they're a few percent of the unit cell. If you have something that is really wildly distorted, well, you then might want to go back and make better crystals, right? Because if it's wildly distorted, you know, this looks like a snowstorm, actually. Your diffraction spot, you see the first order, and after that, it's like, poof, somebody put like a cracker, you know, just blows the spot up and it's just scattered everywhere. And then you know that these crystals, although you can do a little bit with them, they're probably not going to get you very far. Right? But doing that, it basically allows you to take a crystal that nominally, if you get it, diffracts to about 15 and extend it to about 7. Now, the difference is you go from blobs and molecules to seeing alpha helices in the case of membrane proteins, which is quite an improvement because one of them is a, you know, Phelps ladder and the other one is a cover of Nature. So you tell me which one you prefer. So there we go. So this is just... one thing. Now we have to deal with a different issue, and that now that we have really correct our ladders and get beautiful resolution to... Yeah.
Before you go on, how in practice are you then applying the translational correction? Are you using that as a warping function and warping the image and then doing Fourier transform, or is it done by some other method?
No, you actually take the original image and you take its bits, like chunks of densities, and you write it into a new image array. Where all the chunks are in the right positions. So you do a real... basically create a new image that is corrected. It's sort of... And yeah, the functions that you want to use, you know, there's different options in the programs. You can do just the plain thing where you say, well, you know, I know where the peak is, I do the four nearest neighbor interpolation, right, and then bilinear. Or you can do it with a spline fit if you're more complicated, if you want to be more sophisticated. Yeah. Correct. It does not. That does not. If your specimen moves, you're screwed. But you're screwed in a nice way because whatever is along the direction that where it's moving is, you know, sort of still or perpendicular is still there. So you can get some information out of it. But no, it's completely correct. You know, the challenge there really becomes for the 2D crystals. How can you record perfect images, especially at high tilt angles? And you will understand why that is a problem later. If we get to this point. But our problem that we have right now is that now we have extended our resolution, and if you think back over the past 2 days, so Bob has been talking a lot about this contrast transfer function. That is not messing with our minds. It did that in the mid-80s and 90s, and now it's messing with the phase values, actually, and the amplitudes, and we have to somehow deal with this. Now, this function, as Bob said, is some sort of a sinusoidal variation of contrast across the image, and it depends on the defocus. Right? So if I just calculate that function, how the tone ring pattern, as we call it, would look like for one defocus, and then I go to a higher defocus, you can see that there's more of these oscillations, and they all start creeping in. Now, why would that be a problem? Can any of you see why that would be a problem? What do you care? Life's short. No, get on with it. Yeah, for one, it gets worse. There's an envelope function that really tapers down the intensities. But what is also bad is that you say most of the data you lose in the zeros, they're not there, right? Plus, even if we have a beautiful signal from a single image, remind you, that is one of the disadvantages for 2D crystals. You have thousands of images, but all in the identical same orientation. To calculate the structure, you need different views. That means... even right off the bat, you know, I will have to combine data from different images. Now, if these different images have been recorded by different defocus levels, how am I going to do the combination, right? Because what's happening in every single one of these positive modulations is that you swap the contrast. So if one Fourier component in this image is on this node and the next image is on the neighboring node, then their phases will be 180 degrees out of register. I average them and I get a beautiful 90. Right? Well, 90 doesn't get me anywhere. It's random, okay? So it's not calculating the right structure. So somehow I have to deal with it. And that becomes quite obvious now because this phase contribution here, that is how it looks like in the tone ring pattern. As you can see, my diffraction maxima are superimposed on that tone ring pattern. Right? But luckily for us, in the 2D cases, we can precisely calculate where these zeros are, so we know exactly on which one of these modulations each of the diffraction maxima is sitting. And then it becomes very easy, because for every single one that is sitting on an odd modulation, I just add 180 degrees to the phase to bring it back into the same contrast register with its mates on the even parts of the modulation. And the difference here in just visual terms is that if you do the Fourier summation, what that does is that you actually really sum everything. If you don't correct for the CTF, then what you actually do is that a significant number of the reflections, instead of adding them, you're subtracting them. Because the phase shift by 180 is a multiplication with minus 1. So instead of putting it in with positive contribution, you're just subtracting it. And this does really bad things to your image. And this is what hopefully drives it home for you, is that you say, this was the pre-image I showed you, right? Generated from the transform, but not corrected for the contrast transfer function. Now, how does the same image look like if I do that correction? Looks like this. Right? And if you haven't heard the rest of the lecture, you would say, well, what has that to do with this one? Right? They look completely different. Well, actually, no. You know, that is basically just describing the objects more faithfully because it has taken care for these periodic contrast reversals and has been generated by applying a coherent Fourier summation instead of subtracting certain frequencies out of the average. Right? So this is basically nothing much you can tell here. In this case, you can tell, okay, it's a channel, you have a hole, you have some helices hanging off of it, right? So this is basically the difference. This is why we do need to correct for the contrast transfer function. And to drive that back home, in the 2D case, we're fortunate that we can precisely predict whether we have to shift the face or not based on the exact zero positions that we calculate from the transform, based on the focus variable operation, kilovoltage or not. Right? So we're not lost there. For single particle analysis, where the Fourier transform is continuous, it gets a lot harder because you don't really know exactly where the zero is. While in the 2D case, we have discrete diffraction maxima once we combine all the data and we see that one of them is 180 degrees out of whack, you just shift the CTF a little bit to just make it fit. Right? That's a beautiful thing. So we know exactly where we're going and not driving in the fog actually all the time. All right. So this was basically what we have talked about. So you start with a digitized raw image, you calculate the Fourier transform, then you filter the image with a small radiance, and what that does gives you a reference area, which you do for which you use for two things. You calculate an autocorrelation map from that, and you calculate the Fourier transform of the reference area. Then you basically mask the transform also loosely, and that still contains all the information about distortion and whatever disorders on the lattice. And then what you do in reciprocal space, because David amounted to it yesterday, you could actually do this in real space like what I did, shift this and then look at every single unit cell individually, but it's very tedious, right? So it's a convolution, taking your reference and shifting it over every single unit cell in real space. What you can do in reciprocal space, you basically just multiply the Fourier transform of the reference with the complex conjugate of the Fourier transform of the raw image, and boom, the other way around. So, but you conjugate to transform, you multiply to transform together, and boom, you have it. You get the full Fourier transform of the cross-correlation map. Mind you, now that does not have phase information anymore. It's just an intensity map, like a Patterson, so similar to a Patterson. So you just get the map with the cross-correlation peaks. And you can match that up in real space now with the autocorrelation map, determine where all your peaks are in the crystal, unbend the crystal by reinterpolating, put each unit cell on its expected position. And what you get is a vastly improved transform that gives you a list of amplitude and phases. So we have accomplished what we set out to do. We basically have taken an image and we have decomposed it in a list of h and k, which is the numbers, the names of the frequencies or the component waves that we need to add. All of them have an amplitude, all of them phase, all of them have some sort of quality measure to it. And what we also have in here is an absolute value of the CTF. Now, the absolute number, or the number, how much of the CTF, what the value of that amplitude, the CTF oscillation is, helps us in correcting the amplitudes later on. And the sign that is in front of this number tells us whether we should swap the phase by 180 or just leave it alone. Wherever there's a minus, we have to swap. Wherever they're green, they're clear to go as is. Right. Yeah.
When you make your reference image, and you, that you're talking about masking the actual real digitized image, it's the small area. The small area that you've identified is what you think that a single unit of your...
It's not a single unit cell. It's
not a unit cell.
But not on the raw image. So this is where we sort of start bootstrapping our problems, is that you calculate the transform and you filter it. And the way how you filter it very tightly, so you get a very large uniform area, and then you just chop out part of that area and say, this is my reference area.
Okay, the area on your transform that you showed, or the area...
of the back transformed image. So you digitally filter, and that basically means you mask it out, and then you calculate an inverse transform that gives you a filtered image.
Okay.
and use that filtered image instead of the raw image to pick out the reference. Okay. Because it shows what you're looking for so much more clearly.
I see. So right? You
Well, the radius is a matter of, this is different for each of the specimens, you have to play a little bit with it, right? But in principle, that is the thing. So you generate a reference from something that's very tightly masked, so you have a nice reference, right, where everything is sort of uniform. And then you correlate it with a filtered image that has already discarded a lot of the noise that comes from the carbon film, but still contains the information in the filter image that is pertinent to translational disorder and rotational disorder and, you know, all these imaging defects that can play into the whole analysis. Yes?
Do you also multiply your amplitude by the value of the CTA?
You sort of do, right? Now, if you want to be cruel...
Or correct based on
the... So if you want to be cruel, you put the same questions to the single particle people later on, right? Because they will make you a long-winded half-hour argument with Wiener filters and this and that. You know, in the crystallography case, you're actually very easy. You basically, what you do is you divide by this to correct your amplitude, right? And now you say, well, wait a moment, if you get close to a zero, what do you do? Dividing by 0.0001, this gives you a very large number, and this is the noisiest part of your data. And that is where people just say, well, we are crystallographers, okay? Life's too short, we don't care. We give it a maximum correction of 5, and this will do, and it does, all right? So we're not really worried, because the one thing that those of you with a crystallography background will know is that if you take a structure factor set and you reset all the amplitudes to 1 and calculate the structure again, it will just look exactly like the structure that you calculate with the real amplitudes, right? Because the amplitudes are relatively unimportant compared to the phases in telling you what the structure looks like, right? So in terms of the amplitudes, we just have to get it roughly right. You know, it's like a 5-year-old drooling or driving, you know, doodling some numbers on paper, and you just take them randomly, put them into your list, and you will do just fine, in most cases. So the amplitude is not that important, but we do correct. And mind you, now Tom will probably veto this, right? Because if you go to ultra-high resolution, you know, real atomic and beyond, then you want to have rather accurate amplitudes as well, right? And so... But to the lower resolutions that we usually get to, right, it doesn't really matter that much.
Now, at this stage, would these be the raw phases, or would you have already flipped them?
No, at that point, I just write them out as they are, and I don't bother about flipping. I do this at a later stage, right? As long as I keep track of the sign here, so I know when I start really adding things that I should be doing the flipping. Okay, this is great. Now, what I do is I have my list, I do my formation, and that is what I get. And now I say, wait, something went wrong here. So what happened? So did I take a bad image, actually? So it's chopping off something. How can it chop something off? Right? And there's no reason to panic. It's like on a 747, only 2 of the engines cut out. You're still okay. So what we have done here, basically, is that what I told you is that in order to describe our crystal, all we really need to know is the content of one unit cell. We need to know everything that's in one unit cell, then we can generate the whole shebang by just cut and paste, cut and paste, cut and paste, cut and paste. Right? So this is one unit cell, and we have indeed everything in there, but it doesn't look really pretty, because what we have not really done yet is we fixed the phase origin to be in a position that makes it look nice. Right? Now we come back to this gruesome thing, the phases. Right? We all go through them as we grow up, but what are they in terms of crystallography? Right? So if you look at this, we just can basically put the bigger picture on. This is a single unit cell, and if I cut and paste just a couple of them together, what comes to you after looking at, okay, so what I did is basically I just calculated a map in P1, no symmetry, no makeup, no facelifts, no plastic surgery of any kind. Right? It's just data here. And I just calculate one unit cell of it, and that's what it looked like, and I see, okay, if that is a bigger picture, then I see, okay, I got this here, and then I chop little bits and pieces of that are hanging off on this end here. So how can I get this to look nicer? Well, this is where now all the crystallographic tricks and gimmicks set in, where I can do symmetry averaging and whatnot. So it's a difference to some of the single particle applications, where the programs actually need to apply symmetry from the first get-go in order to find what the projections are. We don't do that. We just calculate the raw data, and then we beautify them later. So how would we do that? Well, you know, symmetry is a beautiful thing to have, because if you think of P6, for example, that would be the schematic representation of a unit cell, where you have a 6-fold axis of symmetry at the corners, at each of the corners, then 2-3-fold axis of symmetry, and 2-fold axis of symmetry is behind here. So for those of you who are not familiar with the terms of what the symmetry axis are, 6-fold axis of rotation is basically that instead of just listening to me as a single person, we put a stick up here and we're creating 6 of me around that axis, right? All with a head up around it. And then hopefully not all of us start talking at the same time, because then it would be sort of chaotic. And so the 3-fold axis is just creating 3. 2-fold axis is just rotating this over to here, right, about an axis by 180 degrees. So that basically means our crystallographic unit cell sort of doesn't look like this, but looks like this, right? So this is what I actually want to accomplish instead of what I had shown you, right? I would want a piece of the lattice cut out so that the 6-fold axis is here. Let's go back, right? So if you look at this, you can clearly see there's 6-fold axis here, sort of, if you dream about it. Sort of 3-fold axis here, and sort of 2-fold axis in between, right? If you look for them, right? So, and that is basically what we want. So if we shift this and just cut out this part where we put it, the 6-fold down at the corners, then you can see, okay, there's a 2-3-fold that we need, and there's a 2-fold axis. So they're all there, but they're not really obey it completely. And this is what the noise is in the data, and, you know, the imperfections in the molecule, and the fact that we have low-dose images and not really record the entire truth. But what do we have to do in order to symmetry average all of these things? Now, seeing that this is all in there, is we have to take our lattice, and we basically have to say, well, if this were the real space origin for the 6-fold, well, the 6-fold is not here. There's a 6-fold, there's a 6-fold, here's a 6-fold, there's a 6-fold. So we have to physically take our entire data set and translate it so that the 6-fold axis in the middle of the donut actually coincides physically with the corner of my array. Right? Now, how would I do this? This is again the phase. Translation in real space is a phase shift in reciprocal space. So what I do is I basically take all my reflections and I add phase shift, which physically translates the molecule. Well, the one that I'm showing you in green here underneath is not exactly translating it to the 6-fold, but it's just for the principle, right? So what I did is I basically just added 180 degrees to the 1-0 reflection and then 360 degrees to the 2-0, and, you know, the progressive phase shifts for all the components, and that translated the entire lattice by half a unit cell along one of the axes. Now, if I can translate it along one of the axes, it doesn't need a genius to figure out that you can translate it in any directions if, instead of just applying translations along one axis, you apply a second translation along the other axis. Now, how would I know what translation to apply? See, and about 10 years or 15 years ago, the way how this worked is that people were basically calling Richard Henderson and say, I have this beautiful projection, what symmetry is it? And I would just send him the projection, and he would sit there for 2 days, marvel about the symmetry, right? Send something back and hope he got it right. And he mostly did, right? But at some point, you know, he got so upset about people being lazy sending him their maps to decide what the symmetry is like. He was God or so. So he decided there is no magic behind it. What I do by eye is basically mathematically to look for phase constraints. If you have symmetry, that basically means that not all of the frequencies that you have determined are unique. Symmetry basically means that some of these waves have to be related to each other. And depending on what the symmetry is, you can precisely predict what those relationships should be. If you look at the crystal of an at the image of an untilted crystal, where there is no sort of distortion from projecting the tilt, actually. And this is what Richard came up with. He came up with this program called AltSpace, and what that does, it takes your P1 data set centered in the middle, and it just applies incremental phase shifts, and then it determines, are the symmetry-related reflections in my data set at the same phase? So, for example, if you have a 2-fold axis somewhere, then all of the reflections and projection have to have a phase that is either 0 degree or 180 degree. No choice. So what you can do is, if you start in P1, all your phases will be far from 0 or 180. They will be just all over the place. But what you can do is you can introduce incremental phase shifts and look whether all of the phases suddenly become 0 or 180. And bear and behold, there will, if there is a two-fold axis of symmetry somewhere. Right? So what you do is you basically go through all of this and calculate the phase errors that are arising from comparing the theoretically identical reflections that should have the same phases. And if you're not sitting on the symmetry element, you will have a significant error. If you're sitting exactly on the crystallographic symmetry axis, that error will be very small. And that is what is demonstrated here. So as it shifted the data set, it fell into a minimum where it says, well, 7 means there is, on average, less than a 20-degree phase error between the predicted phase relationships. And that means that symmetry is actually pretty good. Now, what it was testing in this particular case was P6. And that doesn't make... That does make sense. I mean, we were looking at it and say, well, it looks 6-fold, it has a 3-fold, has a 2-fold, so it should be P6, right? And indeed, the phases suggest that if you apply that particular phase shift, you know, like it says 30 degrees in X, 3 over, and then 110 degrees up in the Y direction, you actually will wind up centering your lattice on a 6-fold axis of symmetry, right? And that is what it tells you. So we have 17, what we call two-sided plane groups of symmetry. And for each of them, there's a lookup table, what phases you expect to be the same. And all it does, it completely mind-numbing, shifts the thing data set around, compares them, prints a phase error, and whenever it gives you a little star, that basically means, bingo, you won the lottery. Okay, that symmetry seems to be okay, and it would be okay to apply it to your data set. Right? And that is basically how we do it. So once we've found the symmetry, we can merge in that space group, folding all the reflections over into the asymmetric units, so we know what it did, average it, and here what it looks like once you've applied the symmetry. Right? So this is a projection of this gap junction channel that Mark had been talking about on the first day when he gave this grand overview. What you see is that you see sort of the helices on the outside, you see the channel in the middle, and some sort of whatever in the middle, right? So interpreting these things can be very treacherous and dangerous, so you want to be careful. This is just to show what we do with a single image. We start with a digitized array, extract the amplitude of phases, determine what the symmetry is, and at that point we basically have all the information that's needed to calculate the representative view obtained or given by that particular crystal. Now, we will spend 3 more minutes to go into how do we calculate a 3D map, because obviously that is not three dimensions. Yeah?
Can you go back one slide for a second?
Yeah.
In there, you've got a 13.5 phase residual for P3, but 15.4 for P6. Are you taking the higher one because there's so much more symmetry in P6 that it's worth the little extra phase residual?
So that's a very good question. So here's the thing, what I have omitted here is that you say, yes, you take the higher... You like the higher symmetry, the higher the better. Okay, and you take that into care because what you need to look at is that you say that calculates 13.5 for 40 reflections. This calculates 15.4, which is really not that much more, on average for 105. So it's 3 times more constraints that are obeyed. That you say, well, you know, you do have noise in your data, right? You have to acknowledge this. And what the program also does for you is, before it puts a star here, it actually does an internal calculation based on the signal-to-noise ratio of your measurements, what the expected phase error should be for any one of the given plane groups. And as long as you're below that or at that, it will say this is an acceptable symmetry. Right? And then you would go with the highest one that you can possibly get away with, right? Because it gives you the highest amount of averaging. But that is, yeah. So there's one more column here that I left out, right? That would tell you what the target residual is. And, you know, in this case, it may turn out that the target residual is 20 degrees or so, based on just statistically modeling what the phase error is based on the signal-to-noise of your reflections. Remember, in this input list, we have an indication how well-defined every single one of the reflections is because we can measure how many times above the background noise level each of the amplitudes is. And the higher you are above the background, the more reliable your phase estimate becomes. Right, for that component, and that is what allows us to do a lot of, you know, smart things with our data. All right, so what we have to do then to get the 3D maps is very simple. So all we do is we basically take our crystal and we start tilting it with respect to the electron beam. So we're not tilting the microscope as David, you know, pointed out yesterday. So that would be tedious and drift would be much worse if we were to do it. So we just tilt the crystals, and what I've put on underneath is basically how the projection is changing as a function of tilt. And that also makes immediately the point why you will only be able to determine the actual symmetry of the sample when you look at the image of a truly untilted sample crystal, because only then will you see what the symmetry is. You know, this has what, 15 degrees of tilt, and if you ask me, that looks like a Picasso, right, if you color it right. So you could just put it up in your living room and say abstract art. Certainly wouldn't guess that this was six-fold symmetric, right? So that is something where we go into this whole concept, is that what David pointed out, that we have this projection theorem, that every single one of our 2D projections corresponds to a plane in the three-dimensional, through the three-dimensional transform of the object. And what we can do is that each of these planes basically is connected with every other of these planes by a single shared line. And what our task becomes in 3D is first process the images along the lines that we have been talking about for the past hour to generate the list of amplitudes and phases, and then jump into reciprocal space and figure out, can we give the orientation of these things so that we figure out what the orientation of these data sets are with respect to each other in reciprocal plane. Right? Now, and if you do this for single particles, and if you have no symmetry, good luck. Very difficult, right? Because even the startup routines and the programs that say they can do it, they may. Right? But you know, the advice we got is that just try some Euler angle assignments, calculate the structure, back project. If it doesn't look like your object, bad luck, try again. You know, so until you get it right. So we fortunately can actually calculate what the tilts are based on the changes in the tone ring pattern very easily. And we also can use the distortion of the unit cell vectors. As you project the unit cell vector in projection, it will be distorted, and the angle will change. And from that, we can actually very accurately determine what the tilt geometry is. So we have no ambiguity how to slot this into the three-dimensional transform, other than getting the sign of the tilt angle wrong, having a positive tilt assigned to a negative tilt. That makes a mirror image of your structure very easy to fix in the end, if that ever happens. But that is the whole principle, and the data, how they look like then, is the concept that we're going through here, is why we have to do this, or what the data structure looks like, is that although we calculate discrete diffraction patterns in the XY plane, along the third dimension in a two-dimensional crystal, you have no repeat. It's a single copy of the molecule, just in a regular array, or in some of the plane groups, you have two copies if there's a two-fold axis relating the two. But if there is no stacking, and that basically means there in the third dimension we are a single particle. Now, being a single particle project in the third dimension means that our distribution of amplitude and phases in the third dimension is no longer discrete. So we have no diffraction spots along that third dimension. We have a continuous variation of the numbers, and what we have to do is we have to determine what the amplitude and phases are as a function of tilt. And you can see, you know, we always record our image like this. And what David taught us is that Fourier transforms, if you rotate the object, its Fourier transform rotates with it. Right? Now, that basically means if you figure a sphere and there was something going through here as a plane, and I start rotating that, then that plane that I use for the imaging cuts through a different plane in the three-dimensional transform. That basically means along these lattice lines, I will measure some value of amplitude and phase, and it will give itself away as a discrete spot in the diffraction pattern, because I'm still looking at something that is periodic in the plane, right? But instead of having the pretty repeat of the hexamer with the channel in the middle, I just have a repeat of this thing. That's still periodic, so I will have a discrete set of amplitudes describing it, amplitude and phase describing it, but there will be arranged along these what we call lattice line somewhere, and it will be a value that can be almost anything, right? And that is just emphasized here. So that you say, in projection, that is what we would be getting, and if we go up one of these lattice lines and try to sample the amplitudes and phases, so these are the phase values, and you can see they're all over the place, they change quite a bit along the lattice line. And then we have the amplitudes down here. And the way how we get away with now doing a crystallographic reconstruction is that computers don't like to be fed continuous lattice line data. Because how would you read them in? I mean, you can say to a computer, look at it, okay, and then you know. It just says, do not understand, come again. Right? So what we do instead is that we say, well, we know what the thickness of our sample is, sort of, give or take. Right? And that basically means if we know what the thickness of our sample is, if we had a three-dimensional crystal, the unit cell repeat of the reflections along the third dimension would be 1 over that thickness. Right? So what we can pretend is that we say, well, we know that this is a continuous variation, but we know that the phases have to be constrained within 1 over the thickness of our object. So if we sample these lines in discrete points along the variation at spaces at least 1 over thickness, then we should be able to retrieve the full information by having an HK in the plane, and each of these lines would be an individual L in X. So, you know, we would be, L would be 0, that's a projection term, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So we would have a 250, 251, 252, 253 describing a three-dimensional wave that I can use to just add it up in a crystallographic way using the regular crystallographic software to calculate the structure, right? So this is basically what the three-dimensional volume then would look like from the site if you collect enough data. And that mark had shown actually as a structure, so the gap junction, where you have two channels basically. So this is one of the rare instances where you have a double-layered crystal, right? Because you have one copy of the molecule up here and the second copy down here. But they're in registrant, you can describe them as one six-fold object, and what saves the grace is you can describe them as one six-fold object because they're facing the other way. All right? If they were facing this way, then you're in trouble because that is a repeat and you start sampling. If they're facing this way, I can pretend I don't know that it is the same thing, just being flipped upside down. Right? I can solve it as one big object. I'll get away with it. And you have the two membranes, the channel in the middle, and you can make all sorts of wonderful statements at that point. And, you know, as I said, you know, I was a postdoc when I did it, and I got a job. Right? So, you know, the excitement bears fruit at some point. So there we are. So now you know all there is to know about the 2D processing. And those of you that take the practical, so we will talk about all of this again.
Yeah, sure. So my question was for these tilts, you collect both the diffraction image and the regular image, or how do you do that?
It depends on what your specimen is like. So what you would do is if you have a big, beautiful specimen that is ordered to near atomic resolution, then what you do is you spend the first 2 days or the first week, Tom, something, a week to collect the diffraction data. Is that fair to say? 2 weeks. 2 weeks to collect the diffraction data and about 5 years to collect the images. And then you're done. So it's really that you say, ideally, you would have the diffraction amplitudes because they're so much more accurate because they don't care if your sample is moving or vibrating or whatever. You just get the amplitude of it, all right? There's other snacks. You have to have perfectly flat and everything, and that is just not easy either. That's why it takes about 2 or 3 weeks to really nail this down if you have a perfect setup. At our microscope, the diffraction would take forever, okay? So, but anyway, so you would do that in an ideal world. If you have something that is more typical, that you get to somewhere 6 angstrom, and you have crystals that are less than a microns in each dimension, then, you know, you don't really bother. Because collecting the diffraction is not going to help. It will not be very beautiful diffraction data. And it's not really going to do much. You know, if you go to 6 angstrom, what you usually do is you take the image-derived amplitudes and smack a B-factor in there to bring them back up to where they should be, right? And the reason why we can do that very easily is we have a very good sense for how well-defined every single one of our phases is, and we can use the definedness of our phase as an additional weighting factor so that putting in a big B-factor that is emphasizing high-resolution detail will only happen for those high-resolution frequencies where we have a very good phase estimate. Everything else will be just downweighted again by the figure of merit. So that is how you would go around at intermediate resolution.
And so then, if you're using images, do you also apply this skewing in the three-dimensional model that you would make of your crystal? Or
which skewing?
Well, so you were talking about skewing.
unbending you do independently, okay, so the unbending you do for every single one of the images.
Including the tilted.
Included all of the tilted images, because, you know, the tilt is not really mattering much in terms of putting everything back onto the right position. If you have a disordered crystal, this will be disordered, you know, whether you tilt it or not. And you want to correct for that disorder as far as you can, or as much as you can, in either case. Yeah?
If you have a fully randomized disordered crystal, but it's still in the plane, and you have many, many particles, why can't you use single particle analysis on each individual of the many, many particles that you have to come up with some kind of structure?
Well, in principle, you could. Okay, the one problem you will get is that as a single particle, people point out, the single particle person's nightmare is to box 1 million particles, because you have to have lots of images, because the particles need to be separated to avoid overlap. Now, if you have what you say in the plane, then what you're talking about randomness will most likely be rotational randomness. Okay, and that means, okay, if you were to do it crystallographically, you get a rotational average of that assembly, but no detail about the molecule. Now, if you want to do a single particle reconstruction, you need random orientations. And that means you would have to take that array and tilt it. And the moment you start tilting, the projections of the neighboring molecules start overlapping. And that's the end of it. Okay, because if you don't know what the structure is, there is no way for you to tell how that projection is actually related to the exact view of the object, because part of the projection is from the next object. And if you don't use the crystallographic information, there's no way of telling. Is that right?
But if it was, if it's fully disordered and dilute, then you wouldn't have that problem.
So if you have a big membrane, let's say, right, and you have a particle over here, and a particle over here, and a particle over here, then you can do that, yeah. You still will have to tilt, though, and that is painful.
You compute a crystallographic R factor, and if you do, when you start getting some how low does it have to get before you start getting some confidence that you're getting pretty close?
Okay, good question. So, yes, you do calculate R factors when you fit the lattice line data. That allows you to calculate an R factor. Now, we don't really pay much attention to these R factors, right? Because they're all intensity derived values. What we look at is, what is the phase residual? What is the phase error to the limit of resolution that you want to go? And as a rule of thumb, right, as you have heard in the dispute earlier, 50 looks pretty good for something that is close to atomic resolution. Right? If you look at something that is sixth resolution, if I have to review a paper that comes in with more than 20, I think go back, collect data. Okay.
Can you go to your last slide?
My last slide? This is the one that I didn't disclose. Oh, there we go. Sorry. I have to go. What about it?
Well, how do you know when to stop?
I can tell you when to stop.
Maybe the R factors. I mean, they
B factors, not R factors. Difference.
B factors look like they're creating information. To the naive.
No, they're not really creating.
I mean, suddenly you get, you have a little bump here, and then suddenly you get something that you interpret as an alpha helix. If you put this up to 2,000, will you see atoms?
Well, you will see something that in projection looks like atoms. There will be tiny little things, right? But it has nothing to do.
Maybe you could poll the audience, those people who do this sort of work. What are the range of B factors that you use, Tom?
We collect diffraction data.
So you don't use any B factor?
No.
We usually go up to 500.
So that's a lot.
Well, it depends on the resolution. You know.
I know, but because you're cheating in crystallography doesn't mean we should cheat in the end.
No, we're not really cheating, okay? We're not really cheating. So this is
just trying to get something.
Yeah, I know.
There's a lot of hands going up. This was a good one. Nigel?
Thinking about the S-topolymer center, we were able to scale based on the we had to apply a temperature factor correction of about 100 angstroms to do that. And, you know, that's using a sort of homologous structure to get the scaling is one tactic that works.
Okay, so that's an objective method of deciding how much E factor to apply. But in a case like this, you know, how did you arrive at -350? I mean, presumably at some point, crazy things start to happen. What are the crazy things?
Okay, so the crazy things I'm looking for is at the log file when you calculate the structure, actually. So when you apply no B factor, there will be one reflection in your data set that is the strongest reflection. All right. If you start putting in B factors and you start seeing that the 3.516 becomes the strongest reflection, I say, I like you, darling, but you know, I don't think so. Okay, because that is a very high frequency ripple that is just tearing apart your structure. So, what do you?
So things start appearing where they shouldn't.
Yeah. So the thing why I put this up here is to make one of the points is that because it had been a big discussion is what is a valid sharpening actually. And this is basically to just show you that this is how it looks like without a B factor. And we know that we have amplitude and phase information out to about 6 angstrom. Now, everybody can look at this and say this is not a 6 angstrom structure. It doesn't have 6 angstrom definition. And the reason why it doesn't have that is because the low-resolution terms are a lot stronger. Like the high resolution, you have the envelope of the microscope. At low resolution, every single unit cell contributes to the diffraction. At high resolution, some of them may poop out. Right. So what you observe here is basically like an elephant sitting down on a tomato. Boom. You squish the high resolution information. It's just gone. And that is what we do here, sort of a little faceless thing that you start titrating in some B factor, which exponentially brings up the amplitudes at the high end. And now, the way how you can do this is actually that you say, in most cases, people will do that not by scaling against a known structure, because in many cases, there won't be any homologous structures solved, right? They do what does look good, okay? And when it starts to look ugly, you stop. Now, this is not a good criterion, okay? But what I did here is actually, I said, this is 350, right? And that basically is 680. So if you set all the amplitudes to 1, I didn't weight all of the phases sort of the same. The point I tried to make in that figure is that even you do that sort of very drastic measure, your structure still comes out similar to what it actually is. You still see these things that are now strongly enhanced. You see the helices, this is the inner peak is still there. Then you see these little ears here on the side, and actually you might think those are noisier, but as it actually turns out, when we solve the three-dimensional structure, this is actually the top end of one of the helices coming very close to that helix over here. So even that is not noise, it's in your projection, but it's not very a strong feature, right? The only thing that we could not verify in the 3D structure is actually that blob here on the twofold axis. But, you know, symmetry axes are always suspect because that is where your noise will start building up the fastest, right? So definitely that is not what you would have put in a paper because it does seem a bit overdoing it, all right? But to me, the important argument is actually what is the biological argument you try to push with your paper, right? And with the projection, all we want to say it's a hexamer, has a hole in the middle, there may be some alpha helices, that is your story. I see the hexamer, I see the hole, the alpha helices, I have to believe you. Right? With this one, you can see that the alpha helices are there. No questions asked. Right? And if you have a phase error that is 15 or 20 degrees out to that resolution, you know that whatever enhancement you did is still faithfully describing what your structure actually is. But Nico has probably much more insight. Yeah.
Towards higher resolution diffraction patterns. And as you cool the sample,
slightly different origin. I mean, what is happening in the crystal is slightly different. There's no vibration due to temperatures. It's actual frozen in this order. And so, therefore, these temperature effects are much larger than what you would expect from this temperature. But the fact remains that these are random displacements, or at least that's the assumption, random displacements from the lattice projection. So therefore, you have this exponential that should correct the amplitude. So it's not cheating. There's a real reason behind this formulation there. But of course, it is cheating if you don't have, if you have no idea what it should be and you just adjust it until you like the math. And so, I guess one, Richard Henderson and Wolfthal wrote this paper in JMD, I think in 2003, where they investigate a little bit what an ideal fall-off of the amplitude should be. If you have no disorder, no temperature, and so on. But essentially, the fall-off of the amplitude should be given more or less by the scattering off of individual atoms. That is all calculated on. How the single carbon, for example, was gathered. And there's also a fall of amplitudes just because the carbon or any atom is on a point scatterer and has a certain volume. And so these, on average, would tell you how much, in the ideal case, how much attenuation towards hypersolution you would expect. And you can take that as a guide, I guess, to see how much you should amplify in high-resolution terms in a 2D crystal, for example. Of course, there are other things that on top of this atomic scattering that play a role here. For example, alpha helices will give additional bumps to this scattering curve. But on the whole, it should follow more or less that scattering curve from individual atoms. And so there is actually a way to tell what it should be approximately.
I was just going to add, the original paper was Kip Archer and Richard Henderson. Their analysis first worked it out. The human amplitudes to the electron diffraction amplitudes have very bit sub scaling. And of course, the danger is that there's a certain point where your reflections end in terms of the amplifying elements. And at that cutoff, there's the risk of having employees that are determination artifacts. And I think when I spoke with Richard about it, you have to use some judgment in sharpening the math. And the math would be zero. You have some idea of the boundaries of the biological structure. And you keep sharpening and sharpening, and there's a point where it'll start to pick up peaks where you think that there shouldn't be mass. So typically, when you're moving on to higher resolution, you'll have a map of lower resolution that gives you a lot of information about the molecular boundary and change of contour. And now you're pressing on to higher resolution. Start to see peaks where there shouldn't be any mass, then you know you've gone too far.
Okay, perhaps we should break here.
Yes.
And reconvene at 11 o'clock.